Welcome to In the Hive here on KCPW. I'm Roger McDonough. Well, we are still in the middle of the coronavirus pandemic. Middle might not actually be the right word. We are still probably climbing the mountain to get to the worst point in terms of cases, hospitalizations, and deaths. There is, however, a growing light at the end of the tunnel. Two pharmaceutical companies have announced some stunning results in the development of a vaccine. Just yesterday, the drug maker Pfizer said its vaccine was 95% effective without serious side effects and 94% effective in older adults. Earlier in the week, Moderna said that the vaccine it had developed was, after early analysis, 94.5% effective. When and if either or both of those vaccines get approved by the FDA, there will still be some challenges to getting them distributed. One challenge getting a lot of attention? Pfizer says that its vaccine has to be stored at minus 94 degrees Fahrenheit. That's a colder storage temperature than any previous vaccine developed. It's a surmountable problem, though. Five Utah hospitals have the ultra-cold storage needed to hold that vaccine, and other hospitals in the state are working to develop that capacity. And in any case, Pfizer says it will send the doses out in specially designed boxes that will just need to be replenished with dry ice to keep the vaccine viable. For both the Pfizer and the Moderna vaccine, two doses are needed, spaced apart by either 3 or 4 weeks. So when might you get your first dose? On Wednesday, state officials held a kind of background meeting to advise Utah media about its distribution plan. And the short answer is that if you're a healthcare worker at one of those five hospitals in the state with ultra-cold storage, and depending on FDA approval, it could be as early as December. Those hospitals, by the way, could have vaccine doses on hand as early as this month, but they won't be able to do anything with them until that government approval comes through. If that timeline holds, other healthcare workers and staff and residents of long-term care facilities could receive their first doses as soon as January. Then, beginning in March, the vaccine would become available to tribal entities, to people who are above the age of 65, and then to groups with a somewhat elevated risk, like teachers and childcare professionals, personal care workers, and airline employees. So when would the general public get their first dose of the two-dose vaccine under this timeline?
All of Utahns, we kind of anticipate the July timeframe when they can start receiving the vaccine.
That's Rich Lakin, immunization director at the Utah Department of Health. During his presentation on Wednesday, Lakin said that this timeline was dependent on FDA approval and on the number of doses made available.
The important part of this to remember is that the Pfizer and Moderna vaccine come in two doses. So each individual that has received the first dose has to receive the second dose somewhere. Pfizer 21 days later, the Moderna vaccine 28 days later. And that really kind of puts a logistics planning into how the vaccine is distributed. Because if we get 100,000 doses and we don't know exactly how much vaccine we're going to receive on the second dose, we have to be careful to ensure that those that have received the first dose can also receive the second dose 21 days later or 28 days later for Moderna. So it will be playing that card as we continue to look at the first and second doses during that time.
There's a new link up at the state's coronavirus dashboard with all of this information, by the way. Head over to coronavirus.utah.gov to see more on the state's vaccine distribution plan. But again, a vaccine seems to be on the way. That's reason for optimism, but not reason to let our guard down. We've still got some tough winter months ahead of us, and we're in the midst of our worst surge in cases and hospitalizations so far. And the U.S. Centers for Disease Control currently predict more than 320 Utah deaths from COVID-19 over the next 4 weeks. For some additional context on what all of this means for Utah residents, yesterday I decided to check in with two people I've spoken with from time to time throughout this pandemic. Dr. Emily Spivak is an infectious disease physician at the University of Utah, and Dr. Stephen Goldstein is a postdoctoral researcher also at the U of U, who specializes in virus evolution and, in particular, coronaviruses. To start with, I asked for their thoughts on the announcement that there had been some vaccine breakthroughs. Obviously, a lot of people are excited about this. I imagine we'll throw some cold water on that during this interview because it's not, we still got time ahead of us. But just on the news of the vaccines, maybe I'll start with you, Dr. Spivak. Is that pretty exciting to you?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's super exciting. I'm very optimistic, probably. I usually say I'm cautiously optimistic. I'm less cautious than I usually am and more on the optimistic side. But I think as you alluded to, there's a lot of nuance to think about that these vaccines, one, are not even emergency FDA approved yet. They're going to be available in limited quantities. There's logistical issues to these particular two mRNA vaccines as far as giving them and requiring two doses spread out, you know, several weeks apart. So there's going to be limited availability. So we all really need to double down and be really stringent about masks and physical distancing for the next few months. But I think this is really, really optimistic news that we've really been operating with like no sense of where this was going for the last 6 months.
And Stephen Goldstein, you know, your thoughts there. I mean, the speed at which this is happening is unprecedented, right?
Yeah, exactly. My feelings in that regard are, you know, as a research scientist, it's almost a bit overwhelming to see how quickly this has all happened. And just, it's an incredible achievement, assuming, you know, the data all pans out as it seems it will. But it, you know, the way to make it count is exactly what Dr. Spivak is saying, is now is the time to just crank down even more than we already have been. Nobody wants to be the person who got COVID or gave someone in their family COVID, you know, a week or a month before they or that person in their family could have gotten the vaccine. So, you know, as hard as it's been, I think as much fatigue as we all have, for the first time, we really do have a light at the end of the tunnel and just, you know, make it count. Take this as seriously as you possibly can and let's get to that finish line.
Can I ask, this is sort of a detailed question about vaccine development, and I don't know if either of you can answer this, but what does it mean to have a vaccine or a vaccine company or developer reporting that a vaccine, you know, has 95% effectiveness? Is that better or worse than other vaccines? I guess, what does it mean to say X percent effective for any vaccine, if either of you can answer that question?
So I think there's actually like a particular math equation they use to that actually gives you the number of vaccine efficacy per se. And that's not, you know, necessarily my area of expertise. But for example, to kind of give people an idea of the magnitude of efficacy that some of these vaccines are reporting, I think Pfizer reported that they had like 170 total cases in both the placebo and vaccine arm of their study. And like 160 of those or something were in the placebo arm, in the people who didn't get the vaccine, and only like 10 or 9 out of 170 in people who did get the vaccine. And the number of people in the trial who got the vaccines was much larger, is my understanding, than the number of people who got the placebo. So exactly how they come out with that exact number, I'm not sure, but the amount of the degree of the protection seems to be pretty profound as far as we can tell. How that compares to other vaccines is a little bit difficult to say because these are estimates from, you know, trials, which are large trials, but it still doesn't compare to the tens or hundreds of millions of people who are potentially going to ultimately get this vaccine. So I think it'll be a few years before we can really say definitively, this is how effective this vaccine is. This is how long the protection lasts for. But certainly something north of 90% is stellar. I mean, we're talking in the range of like the measles or chickenpox vaccines at that point, which are about as good as any vaccine we have.
Dr. Spivak, you
had a question. Yeah, I was going to make the measles comparison because I think it's a really important like point of comparing like flu vaccine, for instance, depending on the year. I think the range is sometimes between 30 and a good flu vaccine, very good, would probably be 60% effective in preventing influenza-like illness. And there's reasons for that. But measles is a great example. And it's going to, I'm going to follow through this point here, but that it's what, over 95 or so percent effective. It depends on how many doses you get, but it's a really effective vaccine. And most of us have not seen measles as a clinician. And it's really effective at wiping out that disease in people who take the vaccine. So the other point I would make is the vaccine that is 95 or 90% effective is 0% effective if the vast majority of people do not take it. So we've seen a resurgence of measles specifically during COVID, but even in the last 5 or so years or even longer, as there's been some of an anti-vaccination or rejection of vaccination movement. So I would temper some of the optimism with the next step, in addition to rolling this out strategically, is really getting everybody on board. We have failed massively with getting everyone on board with masks. We have to get everybody on board and trusting and taking the vaccine.
I want to just make one more point building off of that, Roger, which I think is kind of going with this idea of it only works if you take it. As far as we know, that is particularly true for now for these vaccines, which were not tested so far on whether they prevent infection at all. They were tested to determine whether they prevent disease, which means if you get this vaccine, it's 95% effective at getting at preventing you from getting COVID-19 disease. We don't know yet if these vaccines will prevent infection in your nose. And if they don't, they may not dramatically reduce the ability to transmit. So this people may be thinking, or there may be a temptation to think, even if I don't get it, if everybody else around me gets the vaccine, they'll be fine. But we don't know yet. Some of the people who get that vaccine may still be contagious if they get exposed to the virus. They may just never get sick. And the only way to ensure that you won't get sick from them is if you've also gotten the vaccine. So you know, that's a difference for now. Like the measles vaccine, we know prevents infection, and these vaccines may, and we'll learn that as we go. But for now, the only way to protect yourself when you have the opportunity to get the vaccine, to make sure you get it. The people around you, we can't say for now, are going to do that for you, so to speak.
Well, it sounds like the time frame there is, you know, some hospital workers conceivably as early as December, January, February, March for other healthcare workers and long-term care facilities, July for the general populace. One thing that stuck out to me about the vaccine is that it won't be approved for people under the age of 18 for either of these two vaccines, for children, basically, until, I guess, a later date. And that might have to do with how the approval process for kids works versus how it works for the general populace. I don't know if either of you want to comment on that at all.
Well, I think that the first take home is that the study, and correct me, Dr. Goldstein, if I'm wrong, but that these vaccines have not been studied in children yet is the main reason that they probably will not be approved. And studies in children would probably be secondary. There's also some ethical discussions and an interesting piece, I think it was a week or two ago in the New York Times, about what should the vaccine strategy be? Should we vaccinate the most vulnerable or vaccinate those? It's spread now from these younger age groups into higher age groups in Utah, but, or do we vaccinate people who are most likely to get it and seem to be the ones that are asymptomatically transmitting it or spread it? Like, you know, with pneumococcus or pneumonia, it's better to vaccinate young people. It protects the older people. So there's different vaccine strategies. But, you know, I think eventually we will probably clearly vaccinate children, but the approach that it seems everyone is taking now, again, just its answer is probably made easy by how it was studied. We have data in adults, and so we're going to vaccinate those at highest risk for exposure and for severe complications if they are to get it first.
I think that's exactly right. Yeah, the FDA is not going to approve a vaccine for a population that it hasn't been studied in, and nobody's going to start testing a new vaccine by sticking it in kids before we even know if it's safe in adults. So, you know, just with the speed at which this has gone, trials look good in adults, get it in adults, and then start, you know, testing kids and worrying about that.
And we seem to know, Again, it's a smaller sample size, as you said, and we will see as the vaccine rolls out. But a question that I have is that, you know, both companies, I believe both companies, Pfizer and Moderna, are reporting no serious side effects from the vaccine. And I'm imagining, of course, that that's a standard or a threshold that they have to meet before they can receive FDA approval. You know, that no serious side effects. I you know, Dr. Spivak brought up the fact that there are people who are reticent. You know, it's hard to get people to wear masks. Will we get enough people to take the vaccine for this to be a public health measure that is worthwhile? I guess, yeah, what does it mean in vaccine development to say no serious side effects?
So it means that as of right now, and I would say it's early, right, in the number of people that have been enrolled in these trials, how many months of follow-up they have is limited to see some of these side effects, but there's been no serious side effects that the investigators, and all these are adjudicated, have felt to be secondary to the vaccine. I think the caveat or the caution there is that once you roll these vaccines out to a much larger number of people and in the real world and more diverse patient population, but also people who may have not been the types of people who enrolled in a clinical trial, we are clearly going to see increasing reports of I don't know how serious or not serious they will be, but some potential safety concerns. But I think you're always weighing the risk and benefits, and we are in a disastrous pandemic at the moment. And I think that the data, I mean, I can't speak for the FDA process, not having been part of it, but the data clearly at this point is probably enough, definitely, to give an emergency use approval. A full FDA approval would require accruing safety data, which will be forthcoming from both of these trials as they follow these people longer.
Got it. You know, we could spend the whole show on this, and I, I'm just wondering if either of you want to comment on the science that went into the development of these vaccines. I've read that they were both developed using a kind of novel method, using messenger RNA, mRNA, and that's never been done before. Can either of you give us a kind of quick and dirty version of why that's different or what that even means?
Yeah, I can do that. So messenger RNA, basically, you know, the idea with the vaccines is to expose the person to what we call an antigen, which is, in this case, the piece of the virus that we want you to make an immune response to. And in the case of this virus, it's called the spike protein. And that's generally the major target of the immune response during natural infection. So the idea is, if you can produce a vaccine that gives people a strong immune response against the spike protein, then when they're exposed to the virus in real life, it'll protect them from it. And so traditionally with vaccines, we might have a, what we call a live attenuated or weakened vaccine, which is a crippled version of the virus that we put in and replicates and produces an immune response, but no disease. Measles is an example of that. Another type of vaccine that's traditional might be to grow up a bunch of the virus and then inactivate it with chemicals and then give you that. And that's got pieces of the virus in it that you can make an immune response against. And some of the influenza vaccines are examples of that. With messenger RNA vaccines, we're actually just putting in the piece of nucleic acid that is essentially the recipe for making the spike protein. And we're putting that in, and your own cells are going to make as much of that spike protein as they possibly can. And so we're not limited anymore by the amount of antigen we're able to put in. Like, if you grow up a bunch of virus and inactivate it and put it in, what you put in is all that your immune system is ever going to get to react to. With the RNA vaccines, you're doing the work yourself, essentially, and pumping out as much of the spike protein as you possibly can. And that's probably why we've seen very, very robust immune responses to these mRNA vaccines, both in animal studies with SARS-CoV-2 and with other viruses over the last few years, and in the early human trials that we've seen data for. The immune responses look fantastic, even stronger in some cases than the immune responses that people who survive actual normal infection are making themselves. So from a scientific standpoint,
that's amazing. Sorry, go ahead.
Standpoint, the achievement here was kind of in two things. Was normally mRNA, messenger RNA, is not very stable. So they're able to use some biochemistry tricks to make it more stable, so it sticks around longer, to protect it so it can get into cells and stick around longer, so more of the spike protein can be made. And then also to modify it so that your immune system doesn't recognize the mRNA itself and go crazy before you've even had a chance to make the spike protein. And so now they basically slip the mRNA into your cells. Your cells just think it's another messenger RNA, like the ones they're full of all the time, making proteins that your own body makes and uses, and start pumping out the spike protein. And that is what all of a sudden your immune system wakes up. And by making it inside your cells, you can activate the entire breadth of the immune response, basically.
Two questions on that front, and it's kind of hard to dig into, but the spike RNA is kind of analogous. The spike RNA, the spike protein, is analogous to the coronavirus infection, but isn't harmful to you at all. I mean, or as far as we know, it's not harmful to you, right?
Right. It's just the spike protein is a protein that is just studded into the surface of the virus. So having your cells produce the spike protein is basically just presenting your body the part of the infection that occurs before it even activates. Just here's the virus, react to it, but none of the harmful impacts of the virus actually going through its life cycle that occur after that.
If this works, it sounds like a Nobel Prize coming.
Yeah, I mean, I think I know that the CEO of Moderna has said that the two people who kind of develop the biochemical tricks for making this possible would be worthy of getting a Nobel Prize. One of the things that's amazing about this platform is an mRNA, it's very simple. You can take, the reason this happened so quickly is all they needed was the genes, the genetic sequence of the virus, and you can just plug that into this platform. And theoretically, you could do that with any virus. The day you find out about the virus, you can, if the platform works, it's a plug and play system, and you could have vaccine trials start to roll off, you know, in 2 or 3 months, the way it did. This went from discovery of the genome to into an arm in like 65 days, I think.
Amazing. Why is it only being used for the first time now, that mRNA process?
People have been working on it for a while. The pandemic accelerated that, the urgency of doing that. I think it's a new platform that hasn't been licensed before. So in normal times, the bar for authorizing something totally new would probably just take a longer amount of time. But now there's a huge incentive to get this done as rigorously, but as quickly as we can. I think it was probably coming soon anyway, but not this quickly.
I want to reinforce the fact that this is that light at the end of the tunnel that we've all been waiting for and are excited about, but that we are here in Utah and around the nation and in much of the world in perhaps the worst moment of the pandemic that we've seen. And I don't even know if we're at the worst point that we're going to get to. You know, I've read about our ICU utilization being very, very high, above 85% in some cases, and 85% is apparently the threshold at which, at least on the coronavirus dashboard from the state, we are out of hospital capacity our hospitals are overwhelmed. Just a reminder as to the situation in Utah hospitals, and Dr. Spivak, I don't know if this is something that you can address, but it's the same message that it's been since the beginning of the pandemic. In some ways, it feels like the message has kind of worn off and is needed now more than it was needed when it was being enforced really heavily back in March, April, and May. It's kind of, here's my analogy, is that I think it was my sister who, when she was pregnant but not showing, felt the worst and wanted the seat on the subway and wanted people to treat her, you know, differently. But then when she was, you know, 8 months, 9 months pregnant, people were going out of their way to treat her differently, and she was feeling the best she'd ever felt in her life. It's not a very good analogy.
I get what you're saying. I mean, talking in the hall with some colleagues, we were like, wow, think about like back in March, because we were just talking about the more people we know with COVID, but we're like, back in March, we were like sheltered in our houses, not doing anything, and there was barely any of this virus around. Now we seem to be bathing in it, and everybody is still going out and about, and we're still talking about, okay, can I do Thanksgiving this way or can I do it that way? I get your analogy. It's a little bit like we kind of squandered, I don't know, the opportunity, or maybe we shut down when we shouldn't have. I mean, we've been learning as we go. We didn't know back then. It was terrifying. But I echo your concern, and I think people have gotten so much fatigue. I've had many journalists reach out to me about what can we message, what can we do, and I don't really have any ideas anymore other than this is really bad. Our ICUs run now in the last week or so above 95-96% full. So the state numbers are a little misleading, because if we're looking just at referral hospital ICUs that have the highest capacity, the best expertise and technology or whatever to take care of these patients, most of us are completely jam-packed full. And that's even with extra beds that we've built out. We're running out of providers to take care of them. We've pulled in new nurses and new types of providers to staff these units who aren't used to taking care of these patients. We are turning away some patients coming from out of state. And even some people who need things done, they're getting canceled and having to get delayed. So the problem I see is that I don't think the vast majority of people see this. I don't know how to get them to see this until we look like Wuhan or New York or something, if that would ever even happen here, where you really visibly can see people suffering in the streets or, you know, pouring out of emergency rooms. I mean, I hope we don't get to that, but I think the more proximal thing for people to understand is if you get sick, whether or not it's with COVID or something else, there's a very real possibility in the next few weeks that the major hospitals in Salt Lake City may not be able to take care of you or may not have the right people to take care of you, so that your care may not be of the highest quality that we would usually want it to be.
I get that. I mean, I think about, people have heart attacks, people have strokes. There are a number of things that happen, and there's no schedule for them. There's no preventing them. And if the hospitals are overwhelmed, when you happen to have a health emergency, you fall off your bike, whatever it is.
I'm still seeing all that stuff.
Yeah. You want that care to be there. Yeah. That's a good reminder.
I would point out that July, well, let's go back. Memorial Day, July 4th, Pioneer Day, Labor Day. We have seen spikes in cases with all these holidays. The difference between Thanksgiving and Christmas or the winter holidays and those prior holidays happened during warm weather. I'm sure people were inside somewhat, but most people were outside, and these spikes were probably happening even with gatherings outside. We have cold weather now, and all you gotta do is look to the Northern Plains states, even without a holiday, and see what happens when the weather, when the temperature drops and people go inside and you have a major catastrophe. That's why we are imploring people to stay within your household and not socialize outside.
And I'm assuming Thanksgiving, that's another, I mean, for that as well. I mean, we have the two-week circuit breaker that the governor has put in place, but you would imagine that the advice from health experts like yourself is don't go to your extended relative's house for Thanksgiving.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, my personal and professional opinion is the circuit breaker, or whatever we want to call it, should be going through Thanksgiving and beyond. We don't need to get into why that might not be the case. But yes, I mean, there's a lot of creative ways to think about this. Really, being inside and eating is a very high risk transmission activity. And so we are saying, you know, we have such high rates of community transmission. You really need to have Thanksgiving, the meal, only with your immediate household, which for definition purposes and clarity means the people that you sleep under a roof with. Outside of that, there are creative ways to connect with family and friends. Take a pie to your neighbor and leave it on the porch and stand and talk at a difference. Go for a walk with your neighbors with masks outside after Thanksgiving. Get on Zoom with your family across the country or even here. There are other ways to connect. We really want people to try to not eat inside with family. And if they do, it needs to be very small groups. You need to wear masks all the time, except for when you're eating. Try and eat outside, open windows and doors. There's a whole list of things. CDC has a great Thanksgiving holiday website guidance for that, but I'd really encourage people not to.
I'll stick that up on our website. Dr. Goldstein, are you planning to, you know, encounter people on Thanksgiving? What is your plan?
We don't encounter people very much at all, truthfully. I think since this all started, the most socializing I think I've really done is maybe like gone for a run with one other person. At the most, I would echo everything Dr. Spivak said. I mean, our family is back on the East Coast, and we're certainly not going back there to be with them. But I've been having these same conversations with them about their plans, and other people have asked me my opinion. And, you know, I know it's really difficult for people to miss their families on Thanksgiving, but, you know, Thanksgiving 2020 is really important, but it's not more important than Thanksgiving 2021 through 2029. And so, again, we have a finish line almost in sight. Like, now is really not the time to take the chance that you or someone at holidays, a lot of us get together with older members of our family often who may be at particularly high risk. So, you know, I just completely echo everything she was saying about how to stay safe over these holidays. It's absolutely the right thing to do.
I'm so sorry that we are running up against the clock here, and I've taken more time, I think, than I told you I was going to take from both of you. I don't know what else to say. I'll say Dr. Emily Spivak is an infectious disease physician at the University of Utah. Dr. Stephen Goldstein is a postdoctoral researcher also at the U of U who specializes in virus evolution and in particular coronaviruses. Thanks to both of you for being here. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you, Roger. It was great.
All right, so the message remains, do your part to protect yourself, but in particular to prevent the spread of the virus so that others in your community, especially people who are vulnerable, don't get sick. And we can prevent as many deaths as possible before a vaccine is available, and hopefully soon. That does it for In the Hive here on KCPW, a listener-supported, entirely independent public radio resource. Find podcasts of this and all of our local programs at kcpw.org. Follow me on Twitter. I'm at Roger McDonough. The station's handle is at KCPW. Both Sides of the Aisle is coming up next. Join us again next week.